What's up, gamers, and welcome to Lost at Sea Gaming. I am Hulking Yoda, the captain of this ship, the SS Gamer. And you have just stepped into my captain's quarters, my weekly gaming update show where I talk about my favorite gaming news topic of the past week, discuss what games I've been playing, give tips on some of those games, as well as issue a weekly relevant gaming-related decree. This week, it's all about some exciting news for the next Tomb Raider game and my thoughts on some newly released titles and content, so let's talk about them and dive right into the episode with my news catch of the week. Gamers, if you've listened to Lost at Sea for a while now, you probably know that I am a massive Tomb Raider fan. I love the games, the comics, the novels, the movies. It doesn't matter if it's something related to Tomb Raider. Typically, I try to be there and support the franchise. Now, obviously, when it comes to the games, that is really what drives my fandom and has ever since I touched that Pizza Hut demo disc way back in 1998 on the PlayStation 1. And ever since I got a feel for what the kind of game and series that Tomb Raider is, man, I have not looked back. The most recent rebooted trilogy of games, Tomb Raider, Rise of the Tomb Raider, and Shadow of the Tomb Raider. I mean, one of my favorite trilogies ever, three of my favorite games ever. And man, I mean, obviously we can probably debate for days which was the better game for certain reasons between Rise and Shadow. Regardless, I absolutely have loved what this franchise has done with its last couple of series relaunches. I mean, you think about it, that reboot with Tomb Raider was a second reboot and a generally short period of time, because not too long before that is when they had just tried to reboot the series again with Tomb Raider Legend and then Tomb Raider Underworld and Tomb Raider Anniversary, the 10-year anniversary remake of the original Tomb Raider game. Now, me personally, I loved all three of those, Legend, Anniversary, and Underworld. Unfortunately, Underworld didn't sell as well as Eidos had hoped it would, so the series kind of went dormant again. But I'm glad, because as much as I really enjoyed what they were doing with those games, we would probably not have Tomb Raider, Rise, and Shadow if those other games were successful. So thinking and looking ahead at what they could do next with the Tomb Raider series, man, I can only imagine. The sky's the limit. I mean, the narrative and the storytelling and the gameplay direction that the series has taken over the years, sure, in more recent entries, it borrowed a lot from the Uncharted series, obviously. But, you know, my thing is look, Uncharted borrowed from Tomb Raider, which borrowed from Indy, and they've all borrowed from each other over the last 10 plus years anyway. So it doesn't really matter to me. They all end up being their own thing in my eyes and still being individual experiences that I can enjoy on their own. Now, with the future of the Tomb Raider series really kind of like in the shadows right now, and I don't mean that as a pun here. I mean, genuinely, it's kind of very much in the shadows. We don't know a whole lot of what's going on or what we can expect, other than the fact that, yeah, sure, Crystal Dynamics, the developer on the game and on the more recent reboots of the series, they have already confirmed a while ago that there was a new game in development, a sequel, if you will, to Shadow of the Tomb Raider. Now, doesn't mean that it's a direct sequel to it, doesn't mean that it won't be a reboot or a relaunch or a soft reboot again. I have no idea. What we do know now, for sure, we just found out this past week, very exciting news for me, is that Crystal Dynamics developed Tomb Raider game that's coming out in the future, it's actually going to be published by Amazon Games. Now, for many years, Square Enix has been the publisher of the Tomb Raider franchise, but if you remember, they sold off the rights and different developer companies earlier in the year, this past year or so, and Amazon Games has jumped in there to be that support financially, marketing-wise, whatever the case may be, for this next Tomb Raider game. And that's pretty exciting to me, because Amazon, obviously, I think is going to be, and hope that they will be, a very solid, good partner for Crystal Dynamics. Crystal seems to be very positive in this announcement and very confident in the fact that that will be what Amazon does and their support of them and throughout the development process. Now, the thing is that gets me excited about this. Amazon, I feel like, man, the guys and gals who control this company, I feel like are very much into gaming. And the reason I say that, I mean, think about it. They just recently announced this past week, officially confirmed the God of War TV series, which I will talk about later in the episode towards the end. But they've got that series going on. They got a series based on Fallout coming that they released a teaser image of earlier this year. They also have many other things in the works as far as within their games division. They started Luna. I mean, maybe it wasn't that successful. My point is their desire to have some kind of attachment or involvement in the gaming industry is there. And seeing what they did with the Rings of Power and Lord of the Rings and the respect that they handled that show with, I think, I know actually, it gives me very much confidence in what they'll be doing with the Fallout and God of War shows, as well as now supporting Crystal Dynamics in this new Tomb Raider. Now, speaking of the game itself, it was confirmed the game will be developed using Unreal Engine 5. It's going to be multi-platform, so we don't have to worry about any kind of crazy exclusive deals, hopefully. Hopefully that means there's not going to be, hey, like Rise of the Tomb Raider, or we're exclusive to Xbox on console for a year, or you know, other deals more recently, say Final Fantasy 16 exclusive to PS5 for, you know, the 6 months, the back half of the year of 2023. Sounds like hopefully this game will release on day one on all available consoles and platforms, which is awesome because we want everybody to experience the game that can, right? I feel like limiting the access to Rise of the Tomb Raider really hurt that game. And, you know, Graveyard Gamer, who is part of the Graveyard Gaming Podcast right here on Anchor and many other platforms, he's a great friend of the show. Obviously, we talk games all the time, and that's one topic we've discussed many times, is the fact that we feel that Rise of the Tomb Raider would have been much more successful had it come out on PS4 day and date with the Xbox One. Because at that time, the Xbox One was not doing too well. Microsoft kind of was hoping that Tomb Raider would push forward some extra sales and be that console seller they were looking for. It just didn't happen. And then Uncharted 4 came out. That was a massive, monstrous success. And by the time Rise came out a year later on PS4, those owners had already played through the amazing Uncharted 4. And it just didn't hit. Rise didn't hit as much as it probably would have if it had come out before Uncharted for PS4 owners. Regardless, I think any kind of exclusive deal, timed or otherwise, would ultimately hurt the game and maybe even the franchise going forward. I don't really think that a series like Tomb Raider can afford a whole lot of too many more bumps in the road as far as releases and successes. And I just personally, as a fan, don't want it to go dormant again for 10 years or however many years it may take for them to decide they want to reboot the series again. So Crystal Dynamics went on to say that this is going to be the biggest, most expansive Tomb Raider game yet. It is in very early development, and it is going to be a single-player, narrative-driven experience. So to me, pretty much what we expected, what we hoped for. I mean, honestly, I personally am very relieved in a way to hear that, yes, it is confirmed it's a single-player, story-driven experience, because that is what I want from my Tomb Raider games. I don't want Tomb Raider with co-op added on. I don't want it with multiplayer options. I don't want anything like that. I just want a strict, great story focused around single-player gaming, puzzle-based, amazing environments to explore. Give me that. That is what I want from my Tomb Raider experiences. So it sounds like that's going to be the case with this next entry. And I'm just trying to imagine, like, man, graphically, audibly, dual sense wise, all these different things, what this game is going to be like on Unreal Engine 5 and just playing like a true next gen Tomb Raider. Oh, I cannot wait. And the fact that it's the biggest and most expansive Tomb Raider game yet, I mean, that's pretty a pretty hefty accusation of the game, because I mean, sure, the last rebooted trilogy, it was very much hub worlds. You know, you had multiple hub worlds that you went to, but these things still were pretty big. I mean, they weren't like one massive giant open world, but they still were pretty sizable in comparison to what you had going on within the game world. So to be even bigger than what we have experienced in the most recent reboots, that's pretty exciting as well. Now, I will say I am one for bigger and better, but I'm also one for, hey, don't overdo it. You know, there can be too much of a good thing. You don't want to make it just this massive open world. So I honestly hope they kind of stick with the hub worlds, just maybe make them even bigger, but not, I don't know. I'm still going to be there to try it out regardless, but I would prefer to not have one massive open world like, hey, here's the continent of South America. Go explore. You know, I hope that's not the case. We will see. If it was Ubisoft developing it, I'm sure that they would probably do that. No knock on Ubisoft. I love you guys. You create some of the greatest games that I've ever played and love. But man, if you guys don't love your just insanely large continent-sized open worlds in your games anymore. Now, I will say an interesting comment they also made, Crystal Dynamics that is, was that this is going to be part of a Lara Croft universe across the spectrum of possibilities. And that was the head of Crystal Dynamics, Scott Amos. And he said this in regards to his excitement about the partnership that they have with Amazon Game Studios and the fact that that is going to allow them that opportunity to have this universe across spectrum of possibilities, quote unquote. So what does that mean? Well, for me, I'm thinking that it means quite a few things. I am thinking that they're probably looking at relaunching Tomb Raider in a massive way. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the segment how I loved comics and novels and movies and all those different things that are typically associated and branded with Tomb Raider, right? I'm thinking that they're talking about doing that kind of similar thing with the relaunch or the launch of this next game. I don't know about a movie per se, but I could definitely see maybe they would. It's Amazon, Amazon Prime Video. Maybe they do a tie-in prequel movie, animated or live action or otherwise. Maybe they do something, a TV show just in general that's tied to it that comes out after the game's release. I think more though, it's probably going to be in the realm of a comic book series, whether it's a prequel series, a parallel series, or a sequel series. I also definitely could see a prequel novel. That's a very popular thing to do in these last couple of years. I've noticed with big game releases, they'll release a prequel novel a lot of times. So I could see them doing that. Novels, comics, so on and so forth. So we'll definitely see what those things mean. I don't know if that also means a spectrum of possibilities within the gaming realm of things. Like, is there going to be multiple types of Tomb Raider games coming further down the line? And this is just kind of like the kickoff to that. Is it going to be something kind of like, yeah, Assassin's Creed is doing with Infinity, and they have this hub where you can access multiple types of Tomb Raider? I don't know. I mean, the sky's the limit here, is honestly, as far as the possibilities are concerned. But this announcement, very brief as it was, just got me so excited, if you can't tell, to really just, man, I want to know now what the future of the Tomb Raider franchise is. I can't wait to get my hands on that game when it comes out. It's probably going to be at least a couple years, I would assume, because if it is already in development, but it's early development, you got to think. I mean, it's probably every bit of at least 2 years. So I'm not even considering the fact, even though we're still in 2022, I'm talking 2023, like we're in it right now, right? 2 years from now. So I'm saying I wouldn't even expect to see this game until 2025, to be honest with you. But I'm okay with it. As usual, I would prefer for them to get it right and release it when it's ready, as opposed to push it out to get it out sooner or to rush to meet some kind of time frame for any kind of tie-ins or merchandising or marketing. Let it release when it's right. But man, gamers, I cannot wait to see what it is, what it's all about. Even just a preview, an announcement trailer, a gameplay, anything. I don't care. If I got to look at that for 2 years, I'm okay. I just cannot wait to play and experience the next Tomb Raider adventure. Now let's go open up my captain's log and see what games I've been playing. Gamers, I'm going to start out this captain's log by doing a couple of quick hit opinions on two different games that I tried out this past week and very brief, short play sessions. And so the first one I want to talk to you about real quick is the opinions that I had on the Forspoken demo. Now, Square Enix did release this demo this past week, and I was pretty excited for it because just in general, the game Forspoken, I have been very much looking forward to since it was announced as Project Athia. So to see it being delayed and all the different trailers and different things like that, reading previews constantly, I mean, I've just been consistently excited for this game. So to have a demo release for it was also pretty exciting. I will say that typically, unless it's a demo that can transfer your progress to the base game when it releases, I usually try not to play demos because I don't want to kind of spoil that feeling of freshness when I'm playing a brand new game for the first time. But Even though Forspoken does not transfer your progress within the demo to the base game, I just had to try it out and see what it was like. And I played about 30 minutes is what I'm going to cover here. And I'll just kind of tell you my quick thoughts on what that experience was like for me. So I will say the first thing I'll talk about is the graphics. Now, if you have followed anything online, a lot of people online were really knocking the graphics, saying how bad they were and just a lot of negative stuff. I will say I did not think they were as bad as a lot of people online were saying they were, but I will be honest and say I also didn't think they were that great. There was a certain, I don't know if grain is the right word to use here, the right adjective, but there was just a certain look across the entirety of the visuals, whether it was the world or Faye herself. I mean, there was just something about the design that was almost a blurred look to it. I don't think it was a motion blur or a grain. I don't know, but whatever it was, I wasn't necessarily a fan of it. And I don't know, again, I recognize, you know, the disclaimers there at the beginning of the demo. Oh, it's a work in progress. I understand that. I respect that. But again, this is my experience of the demo and the product that Square Enix put out there for me to try out. So graphically, it's still a solid looking game. Don't get me wrong. Animations are pretty decent. And the world itself, I mean, outside of that grain or whatever you want to call it, everything looked good. I didn't see a whole lot of issue with draw distance, even in this demo or pop-in. So it looks like they are on point or in the right direction when it comes to that. Hopefully by the next month or so when the game releases, if it still sticks to that date, hopefully it will. So graphically, pretty solid, but nothing terrible, nothing crazy insanely good. Now, as far as how the game controls, that was the next first really major impression that I had. I will say that controlling the main character of Faye, it was not bad at all. She actually controlled pretty smooth. I was very interested because of all the trailers that we've seen of how her traversal of the world is and just the parkour and how that was going to actually play out. And when you're actually controlling it as opposed to just watching it being done in a trailer. So it was pretty much as I would have expected it to be. It was pretty smooth. I didn't have any issues with the parkouring, the jumping, the button commands not responding to me or anything like that. And the movement of her, she was just very, very smooth. So I didn't have really any issues with controls as far as her in general and her basic movement or the parkour. But I will say when it came to using magic and we got into combat, that was where, for me, the reticule and controlling that and just a few other things, it was a little wonky. Wasn't as tight as I would have liked it to be. I thought it was a little loose. But it wasn't, again, terrible or unplayable. Again, it's a demo, so I'm trying to keep that perspective in my mind as I'm playing here. And I will say, as far as controls, I mean, I can't talk about that in a PS5 game without talking about DualSense functionality, right? So every step, you feel that subtle tap on the DualSense haptic feedback and adaptive triggers. So that was a lot of fun. And then when you're using different magic spells and combat as well as parkouring, like there's just different subtleties there that are at work within the DualSense. So I can't wait to really fully be integrated into that experience with the actual full base game and all of its different features, because that the developers had even come out recently this past week as well and said, hey, here's all the features that you can expect to experience from the DualSense and the immersion that we hope to give to you by utilizing the speaker, the haptic feedback and adaptive triggers, all these different features of the DualSense. So I can't wait to really experience that in its full capacity. Combat, just in general, didn't really have too many issues with that. Lock-on was good. And, you know, again, spells, they weren't, the reticule and whatnot was maybe not as smooth as I wanted it to be transitional-wise. But in general, I didn't really have any issues with combat. And the gameplay, you know, it was what you would pretty much expect, or at least what I expected from the game. I mean, this massive open area was, I won't say it was barren, but it was a lot of square footage with, you know, just some bushes and trees or rocks. Not a whole lot going on. These long dirt paths and just mountainous sides and outcroppings and whatnot. And at least in the area that I played around in, there was one building that I had made it to, which is where the objective marker was taking me. And obviously, along the way, there are different chests that you can open, and there are different loot items and whatnot that you have that you can pick up in there for crafting or healing and all the basic, typical kind of stuff you'd expect as loot. And once I got into that building, I did look around. There were some different documents lying around that you could read. And just, I don't know, the banter between Faye and the gauntlet that is wrapped around her wrist that talks to her, that was pretty interesting and funny. And I could see that being enjoyable throughout the course of play and the actual game. But I didn't, once I got into that building and I saw the different documents you could read and all this different, what seemed to be lore around, I didn't want to get too deep into that. At that point, it had been about a half hour, and I was like, all right, man, I've played enough of this to know I like this, and I think that come time for the full game, I'm going to really like this. And I don't want to get, again, that freshness feeling when you play a brand new game. I don't want to not have that when I do go to play this at the end of January, hopefully, and have that unintentional bias towards the game. And I don't want to be unsurprised when I'm reading lore, or I don't want to read the lore now and forget by the end of January. Either way, I played enough to know I am going to like this game. I'm pretty confident of that, but best believe when it comes time for that game to release, I will absolutely be talking to you about it and my thoughts on it here on Captain's Log in my Captain's Quarters episodes. So that was the first game. Really quick, short play session just to try out the demo and see if I was going to like it or not. Next up was High on Life. Now, this game was an Xbox and PC exclusive. It was originally released or developed, I should say, as a Stadia exclusive. But through the debacle and mess that ended up being the Stadia, it was ultimately sold off to other investors, and Microsoft got a hold of it, liked what they saw, and therefore ended up making it a Game Pass and Xbox PC exclusive. So obviously, if you don't know what Half-Life, man, that's the other one. Man, I'd love to see a Half-Life 3. But anyways, High on Life, if you don't know what that is, it is actually a play on words within the title, because there are aliens that actually go around and they get high off of humans and killing other beings. That's how they essentially make their drugs, if you will. And this is a comedy, just a straight comedy from the minds of the creators of Rick and Morty. So if you've ever seen Rick and Morty, you'll know the kind of humor that you're in for when you come to play High on Life. And it's all throughout the game. Every square millimeter of this game is just oozing with that kind of Rick and Morty humor, that bathroom kind of humor. And look, I am all about that, but at the same time, it's so rare to have that comedy in general in gaming that it's a nice welcome departure from the norm and the seriousness of saving the universe and the world all the time. You know, it's just, you're doing that within this game essentially, but it's in the way that you're doing it that is just so hysterical and still fun. And that's the biggest thing I think I have to say about this game. You know, obviously it's just really well written, and it's just smack dab full of dialogue. I mean, your gun that you use as is a living being has eyes and a mouth and talks to you right there as you're shooting and walking around exploring. I mean, it's just hysterical stuff. And it's actually really good combat. I will say that the gunplay is done really well. The controls are really tight. The graphics are actually really good. And I played all the way through. I played about an hour and played enough into it to get past the first major boss fight. And that was a lot of fun. It was really well designed. It was kind of like an old school feeling kind of boss fight. And just these different areas. I got to leave Earth and go to this planet and explore that a little bit. And just, oh man, all the different pop culture references and different inside jokes and stuff. Oh, it was a lot of fun. So if you're looking for a good, relaxing, humorous gaming time, you can look no further than High on Life, because it played well, the story is funny, the dialogue is hysterical, and the gameplay is tight. So definitely, if you were curious about it, I would recommend at least checking it out, because I think you'll definitely have a good time playing High on Life. Now, that was my first two quick hits in the Captain's Log, but now we get to the real meat and potatoes of the segment. And I am now going to transition over and talk to you a little bit about my progression this past week in God of War Ragnarok. Good Gamers, I was able to drop another 5.5 hours into Ragnarok this past week. And if you've been keeping track, that has now put me over the 50-hour mark. I'm about 52.5 to 53 hours total dropped into this amazing experience. And I am now on chapter 13. And there are 18 chapters in the main story. And honestly, it's almost kind of sad and surprising, to be honest with you, to say I'm on chapter 13 of 18. Because it's like, man, it doesn't feel like... It's one of those weird situations. It doesn't feel like I'm that far into it, but it also feels like I'm that far into it. Like, I've been playing this for a while. And I mean, look, the game came out over a month ago at this point, and I did have about a week, maybe a week and a half of time where I didn't even play it. I was focused on trying to get through the Assassin's Creed DLC, as you'll know if you've been listening to the show, and among other things. So it just kind of... I lost a week or so to it, and that makes it feel that much longer. You know, when you go for a longer period of time without playing a game, it makes you feel like you've been playing it longer than you really have. At least that's how I feel sometimes. But this 5.5 hours I played this past week of Ragnarok, it was amazing. Obviously, this game is just nothing but amazing for me and my experience in it. You know, last I left you, I was talking about re-exploring Svartalfheim, the realm, and mopping up anything that I saw that I can now access with the Dropnir Spear, as well as other new abilities that I've acquired. And pretty much I finished that up. I did everything except for, I want to say it was 12% is what's left. But if you look at the items that are on the map that I don't have checked off, I think there's a total of 4. And one of them is a berserker fight that I was just, it was not happening. I tried it a few times and I'm like, nope, I'm going to have to come back to this guy whenever I get leveled up a little bit more, because this is not happening for me today or anytime soon. And then there's a couple other things, but overall, I did feel like I put my time back in of a second run through, if you will, of Svartalfheim. And honestly, guys, I was just really ready to get back to the main story. I mean, the main story is so good in this game. And really, the only thing keeping me from it was myself. So I was ready. Hey, I did Svartalfheim. Let's go progress this main story and see what's going on. And I got to tell you that I did do that. And man, it took me on another exciting journey with Atreus and a new companion to a part of the realm of Helheim that I have yet to be a part of in this game. And let me tell you, there were some great repercussions to the story in the game's world that came from this sequence. But that's all I'm going to say, because without the details, to avoid spoilers, which I do not want to be that guy, let's just say that at this point, I was able to retain control of Kratos, who also finds his way to Helheim. Some really cool things happen here, and then more main story progression, and ultimately, I am now back in the beautiful, absolutely gorgeous realm of Vanaheim. And, yep, you guessed it, there are areas that I could not access the first time through, maybe even the second time through during the daytime, because you start out in the nighttime, go to the daytime, still some areas that you can't do yet. Well, now I am going through those areas, and man, it is just an amazing gameplay experience. The gameplay in this game is just really what gets me going every single time. It's just so well done and so good. The level design, the puzzles, the combat, I mean, it's just, man, everything about this game, I still can't believe it did not win Game of the Year over Elden Ring. But I digress. So that was my time in God of War Ragnarok this past week. But this next game I want to talk to you about, it was kind of a surprise for me this week. And that game is Bayonetta 3. So this past week, I dropped about 2.5 hours into Bayonetta 3, and if you didn't know, it's a Switch exclusive, meaning, for me at least, 99% of my Switch playtime is usually within the last, I would say, 45 minutes to an hour in bed before I actually go to bed each night. Now, I don't always stay awake for that full amount of time. A lot of times it's more like I am able to stay awake for 20, 30 minutes of it, and then I either pass out or I go to sleep. In this case, I actually had a pretty consistent 3 or 4 nights with Bayonetta, 20 minutes here, 45 minutes one night, 20 minutes there. Regardless, the 2.5 hours that I played this past week, and you know, if you've been listening to the show, I've already played this game before this 2.5 hours. I've probably total now dropped about 3 to 3.5 hours into this game. And overall, I liked what I had played before this week, but something happened this week, gamers. Man, And I'll get to that a little bit later in a different segment. But let me just say, as far as my progress is concerned, I started out with some pretty epic demon riding on the rail sequences, we'll call them, that were starting out my portion of playtime this past week. And ultimately, that demon riding led me to a place I didn't think I would ever get back to, and that is Shibuya, or Tokyo. Now, the reason I say that, if you've listened to my show, obviously for a while I was playing through Ghostwire Tokyo, which takes place in Shibuya, and I love that game. I mean, check out my review if you'd like to get the detailed thoughts on why and how much I love that game. Definitely have that review available on this channel. But regardless, I was like, oh, okay, I've been to Shibuya before, albeit in a much different capacity than I am right now. But still, okay, all right, this is kind of familiar. So, as is the case with Bayonetta, if you've played the series or know anything about it, I spent my time fighting and exploring the area, looking for collectibles. And I came across a cool device that actually allowed me to manipulate time and gain access to a collectible by using broken off pieces of a building as steps in order to get up to the collectible, which happened to be an action figure, a Bayonetta action figure. So guys, I'm a glutton for really cool collectibles. And for me, this was one of many in Bayonetta that I've discovered this past week that are like, oh man, this is actually pretty cool. So I got me a action figure collectible. And the cool thing too about when you turn back time is Bayonetta will go back to her younger form during this short sequence. And you only have so much time, so many seconds, if you will, to utilize the time rewind in order to get it set up for you to gain access to whatever you're trying to do. In this case, obviously, the collectible. But just little details like that I thought was pretty cool. And again, in general, it wasn't just the action figures that I found this past week as I was exploring and finding those collectibles, but there's also Bayonetta trading card packs. There's also records that are music files of Bayonetta. Just all these different cool little things that may be stupid to some, but for me, for whatever reason, I get into that when the collectibles are like that. But through all the collectible hunting and exploration, I ended up going into the underground and sewer systems of Shibuya, further exploring and fighting along the way, eventually reaching the end of chapter, wait for it, one. Yes, chapter one. Now, I will say there is essentially two prologue chapters, if you will, that start out the game, and then you have the first official chapter one. So again, to reiterate, I've only played at that point, I probably only played about an hour or so into the game. So, I mean, to get past the first two prologues and chapter one in a little over an hour, it's not too shabby. But since it's been such a spread out period of time that has taken me to do that, it feels like it's a lot longer. But at this point, completing chapter one, you have the option at that point to look at your collectibles. You can upgrade any attributes that you like. You can replay the chapter for better scores in each verse, because the way the game is set up, each combat encounter is called a verse. So you have a set amount of verses that you come across throughout the course of a chapter, and each combat encounter is graded, whether it's a 10 grade all the way up to like a platinum, if you will. And I've gotten one, I think, platinum grade, and I've gotten a few golds and a lot of silvers. But either way, it's fun when they do that, I think, in these kinds of games, is, you know, grade you on the combat and kind of push you to do better, if you will. But if you are a completionist in that sense, like, oh man, I got to get a platinum in every verse, in every chapter, then you have that option here from that menu screen, if you will, in between chapters to go back and replay them. You can also access the store from here and buy, whether it's different accessories, or you can save from that point, do a manual save. There's other restorative items that you can buy here to fill your health or your magic or whatever the case may be. A lot of really cool stuff. And then after that, I did move on to chapter two, and it started out with this epic train ride, and it took me to a different part of the city, Shinjuku. And that was where I continued to explore. This chapter felt a bit shorter than the first chapter for me, but it was a lot of the similar kind of stuff, exploring, finding collectibles, fighting and going through different verses. And ultimately, I got a new demon that kind of was helping me for the duration of the chapter. And I'm going to try to pronounce this here, Phantasmarena. And it's this giant spider demon that can climb up walls and allows access to certain destructible collectibles, as well as also it helped me progress further in the world by destroying this water tower whose water doused the wall of fire that was blocking my path down below. And not only that, the Phantasmarina is actually very good in combat. You got a lot of really cool moves and very unique and interesting to it. And then the chapter ended, because I did play through to the completion of chapter 2. The chapter did end on a really epic way, using the spider to traverse massive aerial spaces across the city, trying to stay up with and away from this massive demon that was just laying waste to the city from above. And that was just really, really cool. Lots of cool action sequences and different button-timed events and other things that I'll just leave it at that. It was a lot of fun. So regardless, definitely enjoyed my time with Bayonetta 3 this past week and all of the games that I played. But with that being the case, what was my highlight of the week? Gamers, I had a lot of great moments this past week in the different games that I played and tried out, but I got to tell you, my highlight this past week was actually this. It was a multiple list of things, all tied back to Bayonetta 3. It was getting the hang of and just really falling in love with the game, and therefore finding a new franchise to follow. Because obviously there's Bayonetta and Bayonetta 2 that are also available on the Switch that came before this game that I am now interested enough to actually possibly pursue playing those games if I'm able to stick with Bayonetta 3 and complete it. You know, the director also of the series recently said this past week that he sees no less than 9 games in the series. He could see the story going for 9 games. So 3 just released this past October. If we got 6 more games potentially coming our way, wow. I mean, honestly, at this point, though, again, like I said, the franchise has a new fan in me, so I will be following all of them as best as I can. We got the offshoot game that's coming later that's like a prequel origin story for Celeste. That should be really cool. But regardless, my highlight this past week, it was just about slowing down to where I actually sat there for many minutes of my time reading through the lore and the menu system, the demon descriptions, the different character descriptions and what they are and what they mean to each other. Because again, I haven't played Bayonetta 1 or 2, so for me to really try to fully understand what was going on in the game world and where my mind should be at when I'm watching Bayonetta interact with different characters that I may not know, it was really, really awesome to just slow down and learn, really, and just get lost in the lore of what is there in this game world. The terminology used for a lot of things, obviously just, you know, witches and demons and the different versions of hell and all that kind of different stuff, just realms, multiverses, all kinds of really interesting stuff to me that I had no idea pertained to Bayonetta before this game. And before really just slowing down to kind of try to take it all in and get the context of what this game is, instead of just it being something I mash buttons to, you know? And that's where the difference is for me, is gaining that context and that perspective and what helped make a difference. Because I also had to slow down to really understand the combat. The combat to me at first, I was not huge or a big fan into, but after I just kind of forced myself to slow down a little bit and kind of try to learn how the game is supposed to be played, man, I've been good to go ever since. So, highlight of the week, falling in love with Bayonetta 3. Now let's go open up a chest of buried treasure gaming tips for you that I have in Bayonetta 3. Gamers, as I stated in the last segment, I really slowed down to try to understand the combat this past week in Bayonetta 3. So for me, I just kind of wanted to share a couple of quick tips for you that worked for me, and maybe it'll help you out as well if you were like me and going fresh and new into the series and not really fully knowing the nuances of the combat right out the gate. So honestly, I would say the biggest thing to learn right out the gate is the right timing for dodging, because dodging is absolutely crucial, I have noticed, in this game. If you don't have the right dodge timing, you're probably going to get messed up quite often, and that leads to some quick deaths, and that's never fun. So obviously, make sure that you get that timing down when it comes to each respective enemy or attacks. Certain enemies shoot arrows or have long range attacks that they throw at you. You just got to look and see, and the tells of the enemies are pretty obvious, in my opinion, when you need to go ahead and get ready to, and boom, dodge. And that'll set you up for, honestly, the time slows down to a crawl, and then you can just wail on the enemies. And it especially helps out a lot when you have those bigger enemies that you get a lot of, honestly, and you can just kind of wail on them for a few seconds and then go right back to dodging and just that timing. Now, the other thing I wanted to say is when it comes to combat, also don't forget about your demons. There are certain demons that Bayonetta has access to that she can summon for combat. And I know you only have a limited amount of magic that you can use, but as is the case with most action games like this, your magic meter fills up the more you attack and the more you're doing well in combat. So obviously, if you're struggling, go ahead and summon those demons, and especially when those bigger enemies are in your way and just kind of making things a nuisance for you, don't forget to summon the demon. Wail on those guys, take out as many as you can, even if it depletes all your magic, because honestly, I've noticed the magic meter fills back up pretty quickly if you're timing your dodges and you're doing well in combat. So two things: learn the right timing for dodging, and don't forget about summoning your demons. Now it's that time of month again, gamers, where I check in and let you know what my updated progress is with trophy level progress and my gamer score quest goals. Was I successful? Let's find out and start out with trophy level progress. Gamers, if it's your first time checking in on my trophy level progress and gamer score quest update segments, every month I give myself a goal in each category of a trophy level to meet by the next mid-month episode of Captain's Quarters, as well as a gamer score to reach again by the same episode. So this first segment is all about trophies and my progress in my trophy level. So let's see what's that shaped up like this past month. So last month when I left you, my trophy level was 220, 86% complete towards 221. And I had given myself a goal of reaching trophy level 222 by this recording. So was I able to be successful in that? Well, I unlocked 3 silver trophies and 2 bronze trophies this past month, which brought me to a trophy level of 221, 36% complete. So I did not reach my goal of hitting trophy level 222. I was 64% away from reaching that goal. And that's a decent amount of trophies if you break it down based on the value percentage-wise of bronze and silver, gold, and so on and so forth. And playing a game that's as lengthy as God of War and is not as consistently forthcoming with trophies, as well as the different times that I mentioned earlier, I stepped away to play some stuff on Xbox. It just kind of worked out that this month I did not reach that goal. So, new month coming up, new trophy level goal, or is it? So, by the January 21st episode of Captain's Quarters, I am giving myself a trophy level goal to reach of 222. Same goal. And again, I'm trying to be realistic here because 64% is a decent amount depending on how far I progress or not in God of War. It is the holidays, so I may not have as much time between now and that recording to get as much done in it as I would like. Time will tell. We shall see. Hopefully, I'll be able to come back to you next month and tell you that I was successful in reaching trophy level 222. Now let's go see if I was successful in my gamer score quest. Well, gamers, as I mentioned, I did go back to the Xbox a decent amount this past month, and was it enough, though, for me to reach my gamer score quest goal? Well, last month when I left you, I was at a gamer score of 292,120, finally had reached the year-long, honestly, goal of hitting 292,000. So 292,120 was my goal that I had reached, and I gave myself a new goal of 292,500. Because again, I just am trying to be as realistic, but also a little slight challenging to myself as possible with these goals, in the sense that I know and I recognize maybe I won't play as much Xbox, but I can still try for a few hundred gamer score. Let's see what happens, right? So this past month, I unlocked 20 achievements. And those 20 achievements were worth a gamer score of 385. So if you're doing the math, I was successful in reaching my gamer score quest goal. This is now the second month in a row. This is insane. The apocalypse is happening. I can't believe it. 2 months in a row after not hitting it for the better part of a year. But here I am. 292,505 is the gamer score that I currently sit at right now. So I did it. I met and by 5 points exceeded my gamer score quest goal for this month. So that is awesome. And now I've given myself a new gamer score quest goal for January 21st episode of Captain's Quarters. And that is to reach a gamer score of 293,000. So I need 495 gamer score in order for that to be possible. Don't know if it'll happen. We'll see what happens. We'll see if High on Life or Sonic Frontiers or another game on the Xbox draws me back into it enough to get that 495 gamer score. Now let's go check out this week's Captain's Decree. Gamers, earlier in the show, I had mentioned the fact that Amazon Prime Video has officially reconfirmed that their God of War TV series is coming. They are officially moving forward with the show. And the other confirmation that we had this past week that I wanted to kind of touch on and a few other things regarding the show itself is the fact that the show is going to be based on the Norse God of War storyline, meaning that which started in 2018's God of War and has continued and culminated with God of War Ragnarok. So the story spread across those two games about Kratos and Atreus, and you know, they even say in this press release about the story being about a son and a father who are on a quest to spread the ashes and the final wish, to honor the final wish of Kratos's wife, and et cetera, et cetera. We all know the story, right? So it is straight up an adaptation of the 2018 game. Now, a lot of thoughts I have. First one is that right? Is that the right way to go? Should they have gone with the Greek version of Kratos and that storyline first, like the games? Should they have followed that path and led up to him ending up in the Norse realms? Well, the chronological person in me kind of sort of wanted to see that, like wanted to see the Greek version of Kratos and just kind of see it play out as it did over the course of many years and games leading up to 2018's release. But I understand why I believe at least Amazon Prime chose to go with the 2018 storyline. Number one, so obviously I'm not knocking any of the stories from the previous God of War games, the Greek God of War mythology. They were all actually really good, and there was some good stuff there. I mean, just the premise of Kratos as a character is very deep and just like, wow. But I think that when you look at the storyline that I just described, that very brief, basic premise of a father and son going on a journey to honor their dead wife, mother, I mean, there's just a lot there that's emotional already and that could also potentially draw in non-gaming viewers. And I think that is one thing, obviously, I understand Amazon investing their money that they're interested in is not just getting viewership from gamers, but also people who know nothing about the games. And I also feel that the storyline that is in 2018's God of War into Ragnarok, I think those are more easily digestible on a, I would say general audience. I'll put it that way. I think a general audience can get behind that storyline a little bit more than they maybe could the Greek storyline. Now, I will say the Greek storyline, they could have actually played that in a way and spun it in a similar feel to a Game of Thrones style, because Kratos is almost like an anti-hero in those series in a way, because obviously the whole premise for him is just to kill all the gods. I mean, he's just out for blood. You know, that may be another reason why Amazon is like, it's kind of hard to get people who don't know anything about the games to buy into and support and empathize with this character. Now, when they understand why he wants to kill all the gods, I think they would be able to empathize more easily. But I just think there's a lot of convoluted stuff there. Plus, the big thing, me and Graveyard Gamer, again, we were talking about it. One of the things we think is probably going to happen is there will be flashbacks to Kratos in the Greek mythology within the show. So the show obviously is going to be based and 90% probably focused on the Norse mythology of the God of War 2 most recent games. But you got to believe they're going to have flashbacks of him as Greek Kratos and his origin story and what happens to him and why he looks the way that he does and why he is and feels and acts the way that he does. Like, you have to have that context to understand why he's so protective over Atreus in these games. So I think that they'll probably do that. Another thing that I was very interested about, both Christopher Judge, who portrays Kratos, his voice, his likeness, as well as Sully, I can't remember his last name, but he portrays Atreus in the game, voice and likeness. Both of them have gone on record as voicing their interest on portraying these characters in real life within this TV show. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, I am all about it. I am 100% behind that decision if they do that. So I'm sure there's people out there that maybe disagree or maybe want to start fresh and do their own thing and have somebody completely different be Kratos and Atreus. I'm not going to be mad at that either, but I am not upset at the idea of these two actors portraying these characters because they already know them so well. And I mean, they voiced them, they motion captured for them. So they already have like mannerisms and voices and just in general, they've been in the characters' heads for two games now, you know? So I feel like instead of getting somebody starting from scratch, you could start at a good launching point with these characters and maybe make it that much smoother at the beginning of filming or whatnot. So very interested to see what happens with the casting and the decisions made there when it comes to this show. Now, the structure of the storytelling in the show is the last thing that I was kind of interested in. You know, I had mentioned before about flashbacks to Greece. That I think is probably going to be a big part and is going to be crucial, I think, to the success of a general audience buying into Kratos. But how is the storytelling structure going to be? I think it's very much going to focus on the order, the chronology of 2018's God of War. I feel like it's going to start with, just like 2018 does, the burial, if you will, of Frey, Kratos' wife, Atreus' mother. And I think that going from there, it's going to follow the same order of the story across the two games. Now, are they going to try to squeeze both game stories into one season? I personally don't think so. I think that probably the first season is probably going to end up being, they'll figure out how to fit into 10 to 12 episodes, the storyline of the first 2018 game. That's what I would think. Because if you're going to have Baldur be the big bad, if you will, that kind of follows you throughout the course of that season, I just think it perfectly culminates a beginning and an end of a season. And then the tone as well. And then when you go to Ragnarok or season two, I think it would be great to go into Thor and then obviously everything else that transpires throughout the course of Ragnarok. Now, when you get to the Ragnarok storyline, I do see, honestly, they could potentially spread that out into a couple seasons. I mean, they could even probably do the same thing with the first season. I just don't know if spreading Baldur as the main antagonist over two seasons, if that would make sense or not, or if the audience would get kind of bored with Baldur. But regardless, I'm very interested to see what they decide to do as far as the casting and the storytelling direction and decisions that they make. I cannot wait to see this show. That'll do it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed your time aboard the SS Gamer. You can join its crew by reaching out to me via email at lostatseagaming365@gmail.com or search for Hulking Yoda on the Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo Switch networks. You can also find me on social media on Instagram at lostatseagaming as well as on Twitter at lostatseagaming1. Thank you for listening, and until the sea says otherwise, we'll keep sailing.